morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome James McGrath Morris. He is the author of the new book, Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday the 9th of February, at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So this is a great, big, amazing, vividly written biography of Joseph Pulitzer, who everybody has probably heard of through the Pulitzer Prize, but most people don't know anything more than that about.
Exactly. I mean, that was my experience writing the book. It took about 6 years to write, and it's like an interminable pregnancy, and people would always ask me, so what is it you're writing about? And I'd say Joseph Pulitzer, and they'd all say, oh, yes, of course, but you realized at that moment the name was familiar, but nothing more. And he shares that with Alfred Nobel, who we all know about because of his Peace Prize and other prizes. And most Americans know of the Pulitzer Prize. We choose to buy books very often based on the Pulitzer Prize. We're thrilled when the newspaper in the town gets the Pulitzer Prize, etc. But very few people know much about him. And it's kind of sad in a number of ways. First of all, he's a very important figure. And leaving a legacy for a prize made sure his name was remembered, but his acts weren't.
Well, so let's talk about that. I mean, he is an immigrant from Hungarian Austria, came over at the age of 17 years old. He was born in 1847. Why did he leave Hungary, and what did he do when he came here?
Well, there are a lot of things that propelled him to leave from Hungary. First, it's the beginning of a mass wave of immigration to the United States. It's a very early part of it. There had been a large set of revolutions in Europe, which had ended, unfortunately, for people on the wrong side, and that's part of what propelled him to leave Hungary. And a number of family things. The most dominant thing in Joseph Pulitzer's childhood was death. He was one of nine children, only two of which ever lived to adulthood. He lost his father as a young man. So these kinds of psychological blows and no future for him in his homeland, and this remarkable opportunity that arose that, again, many Americans don't know about, which is that to get people to fight in the Civil War, we were recruiting people in Europe, paying them to come here and take the place of somebody else. People remember that there was a draft in the Civil War, but what they don't remember is that rich people could get out of it by paying a $300 check. But the community still needed to come up with 200 or 300 people to send off to the war.
So they'd get this Hungarian person called John Q. Smith?
Well, they actually kept their names, but yes, exactly right. What happened was they sent somebody over to Germany who advertised in European newspapers saying, you can come to America, we'll pay your way, we'll give you money. By the way, you'll fight in a war while you're over there. So Pulitzer joined this ship with all men. I mean, it was really the oddest thing, leaving a European harbor with a ship all of men. I mean, most ships had immigrants, the families, the kids. He arrived in the United States. He got wind of the idea that he was actually being cheated out of some of the money he could get because the middleman was going to make some money. So he and several others left the boat in Boston, made their way to New York, where he did sign up to join the Union Army. He took the place of a young man who ironically died of natural causes a year later, so it didn't lengthen that man's life. And he went off and served in the final year of the U.S. Civil War. Never saw any action, played mostly chess in the valleys of Virginia. I mean, he was a gangly, awkward teenager. Underage, he lied about his age. Long arms, bad vision. I mean, hardly the kind of guy you'd want to lead the nation to war.
Just to say, on the Union side.
Yes, I'm sorry, on the Union side.
So he then went to St. Louis, which was a wonderful place for a German speaker to go.
Correct. His decision to go to St. Louis, I have no proof of what propelled it. He didn't tell me anything or leave anything behind. But it's similar to, for instance, anyone who's Spanish-speaking coming to the United States. You know, there are certain communities that are going to be more welcoming linguistically. You're going to be better off going to Los Angeles than you are to the middle of Iowa where no one speaks Spanish. St. Louis was so German at that time. There were seven daily papers published in German. The street names were in German. The food was German. The music was German. So for a Hungarian who spoke German, because that was the official language of Hungary at the time, it was a natural place to go. Unemployment was high at the time. There was no jobs for veterans. He ends up getting to St. Louis with no money whatsoever. He was down to his last dime. He had to work his way on a ferry to get across the Mississippi River. And that's where he started.
So he quickly got into both politics and journalism, almost simultaneously.
Correct. And politics and journalism were one and the same thing in the 19th century. If you were an elected politician, you lost your job, you went back to the newspaper and worked as an editor until you got elected again. And the papers were political in a way that's harder for people to understand today. The two main papers in St. Louis were called the Missouri Democrat, the Missouri Republican. And these were cheerleading operations for each party, and they were paid for by the party. They were subsidized. There were very few newspapers who made it on their own dime through advertising or anything at that point. And so Pulitzer worked his way into immigrant politics under the leadership of a very famous German named Karl Schurz, who later becomes a U.S. senator and a Secretary of Interior. And that was his role model. So as he got various itinerant jobs, he ended up working on a German daily newspaper called the Westlich Post, and those of you who speak German, I probably butchered the name, sorry. And so there he was working as a reporter and as a politician under the most famous German immigrant politicians in the U.S., and he got elected. He got elected, surprisingly, to the state legislature, and that's what he thought he'd end up doing. The voters changed their mind a year later, and there he was unemployed, so journalism looked increasingly attractive to him.
What were his political leanings?
Well, like most liberal people at that time, he was a Republican. And I mean liberal, I'm confusing terms, but I meant in the sense of 21st century, progressive. He believed in the 15th Amendment, giving African Americans the right to vote. And those were the Republicans at the time. It's hard for people now to understand because the Republican Party has become so conservative, but that's the kind of party somebody like Joseph would join and fit in naturally. And over time, he migrated to the Democratic Party and became perhaps one of its most famous newspaper members.
So he was there. He was in Missouri, in St. Louis. He was a legislator, then a newspaper man, and he rose very quickly. He had this intense ambition. What was driving him?
There's an intensity to him that, whenever you look at pictures and you look at his eyes, he's just such a driven man. He was driven by some qualities of personal ambition. Like a lot of immigrants who'd come to the United States, he believed he could make it here and make it very well. But he's also driven by some things that people might feel is naive today, a sense of politics as a means of change, of improving the world. A sense of mission that, which he carries into his journalism, a sense that there's a right and a wrong. I mean, part of the reason that he leaves one party and joins the other is over an issue of principle. It's not an expediency decision. And these all, I know it sounds really almost oxymoronic today to be talking this way about a figure, but that's the kind of view he had of the world. Politics became for him almost like a religion. He never missed an election day. He believed that there was a higher calling in politics. That's why getting people to vote, the right to vote, was so important for him. I will point out that he didn't share that view when it came to women, but he did believe in enfranchising blacks, and he particularly believed in re-enfranchising Democrats. See, in places like Missouri, the Republicans got into power by taking away the vote of anyone who had a connection to the Confederacy. So if your third cousin twice removed had served in the Confederacy, you weren't going to vote. And you had to sign a loyalty oath in order to have your vote restored. So it was very easy. The Republicans controlled the state because the only people who could vote for him were the Republicans. And this is an interesting issue because Pulitzer, as a Republican, was arguing to allow the others to vote. And anyone who knows anything about politics, what he was saying was, I may lose as a consequence of this. And that's exactly what happened to him. But it's a good example of how important political principles were to people like Pulitzer and those who worked around him at that time.
What was the Democratic Party at that time?
In shambles. It was filled with a lot of defenders of the Confederacy who were eager to get back into power and institutionalize what we later know as Jim Crow. So there were many Democrats who were members of the Lost Cause who saw getting back into power as a way to restore some of the things they lost. But at the same time, it was beginning to be much more of a pro-working person's party, which is what it evolved later into. So there were those elements. A lot of the white disenfranchised folks were becoming members of the Democrats, and the Republicans were becoming wealthier.
We're talking to James McGrath Morris, author of the new biography of Joseph Pulitzer. Let's talk more about the place and power of newspapers at that time in the, what are we talking about now? I guess the 1860s, 1870s. They were, as you say, entirely partisan. They're also very powerful. I mean, everybody read them. There were morning and evening editions. There were competing newspapers in every city.
Some of that comes a little later. They were powerful politically, but they were the propaganda arms of each political party. The rise of what we call the independent press was only beginning, and Pulitzer is at the center of it. So when Pulitzer first enters journalism, most newspapers are cheerleaders for each party. Now, they do some of modern journalism. They often expose corruption and things like that, but their aim is to get the other guy out of power. And it's an entirely different sense. The notion of objective journalism, of the kind of journalism we're more used to, is really an invention of Pulitzer and other men that begins in the 1870s. And classically, if there's a kind of moment in time, it's in 1878. Pulitzer comes back to St. Louis with very little money left. He'd made a lot of money, so he'd been living off of that, but he was aimless at this point. And he buys a newspaper at a bankruptcy sale, sets aside just enough money to run it. And so he's faced with this, I've got sort of a six-month window. How am I going to make an evening paper a success and stay in business? He's married, he has a child coming. I mean, these are really important concerns. And it's the first step we see of Pulitzer's kind of prescience, his ability to see things that other people didn't see. He's not an inventor like Thomas Edison or somebody like that, but he had this uncanny ability to perceive trends. And the most interesting trend at that point, you have the introduction of gaslight, electric light, and you're probably all thinking, what has this got to do with newspapers? Well, it means that when working people get home, middle-class people get home in the afternoon, they can read into the evening, and so they want to be entertained. The morning papers are getting their news in the morning and printing it overnight. The afternoon paper at this point can take advantage of a new invention, the telegraph. So when the afternoon paper hits the stand or the streets in the afternoon, it's actually carrying that day's news. The next morning paper is actually carrying yesterday's news. That's the kind of thing Pulitzer was able to perceive. So he, by buying an evening paper at the very beginning when evening papers are going to start spreading like wildfire, he was really a genius in that respect. The second thing he perceived is that newspapers have been lined up by political party. One is a Democrat, one is a Republican. And in St. Louis, like many other cities around the country, there was this growing middle class of merchants, of tradespeople, who felt stymied because the older group was controlling the economic power in that town. So you had the old guard facing the young new guard. Pulitzer, by championing an end to corruption, an end to special favors, etc., in his paper, became a partisan, if you wish, of the middle class. It wasn't a Republican or Democratic issue. So now they had a paper who came out every afternoon that they could read that was entertaining, filled with great drama, you know, murders, he'd published a piece on who owned the building that all the brothels were in, these kinds of things. So it was striking, interesting, but at the same time it became the leading vanguard, the advocate of changes that the citizenry wanted. And that's part of the key of what he was beginning to develop. It's a notion of journalism that represented a group, wrote about a group, and benefited monetarily from that group because they were more than glad to pay their 5 cents for the paper.
He wanted his stories in the newspaper to read like something out of Charles Dickens.
Yeah, that's another aspect of Pulitzer. Pulitzer always said to his staff that the paper had to publish something every day that at dinner that night somebody would say to somebody at the table, did you see that story in the Post-Dispatch, or did you see that story in the World? And this is where people begin to talk about Pulitzer as a sensationalist or as a purveyor of what was later called yellow journalism. And there is truth that Pulitzer's staff and he himself often engaged in exaggeration. But you can't go too far in the accusation, because if it's a story about a murder, there is still a body, there is still a dead person. Really what we're talking about is the packaging of it, the kinds of adjectives that are used. So the stories are, in a sense, dripping with blood. You might open up the front page of the New York World, This is later when he moves to New York. There'd be a diagram of the barrel in which the body parts were cut up and put into. And the story would read with things like the small child stood in a pool of blood and stared at his father dying on the floor. And this kind of teasing journalism brought readers by the thousands to the papers.
But particularly in the absence of TV and radio.
Correct. This is the internet, the TV, and everything of the time. And part of the cleverness of what's going on here is that Pulitzer is mining the urban life's dramas for material for his papers. And the charge of sensationalism about him is an interesting one. It in some ways is a class fight that's going on. Because before Pulitzer's time, newspapers were expensive and primarily subscribed to by people who had the means to pay 5 cents for a newspaper, which was a considerable sum of money in that time. And Pulitzer's paper in New York was selling for a penny, and it was filled with stuff. But more interestingly enough, we'll get to some of the stuff, I mean, like free sheet music for you to take home and play, all these kinds of things. But what was really important is that Pulitzer was writing about the lower class, the mass, teeming masses that were arriving in New York. And they were arriving on ships every day, and they were trying to learn English. So what would they get? They would get a newspaper that was written about them, for a penny. They could practice their language in it, but more importantly, it gave their lives meaning. So, you know, you go into anybody's house, you look at the refrigerator, and what do they have on the refrigerator? A clipping about their son or daughter doing something. It kind of gives it, whatever the act is, verisimilitude. So up on Upper Fifth Avenue, the hoity-toities were saying things like, oh, how scandalous, you know, this murder on the front page of the newspaper. Well, you go down to the Lower East Side, and you go into what were called the Black and Tans, these were the bars, or you go into these crowded apartment buildings, what were they talking about? They were talking about that murder, or they were talking about Mrs. O'Shaughnessy's baby who fell to its death from a window, or how the cops beat up some kid on his way to work someday. These are the issues that mattered to him, and these were the issues that were in the world. So his genius was to learn to write about that audience, for that audience, and then make his millions off the pennies that they paid for the paper.
Now, did the same people who were reading these stories about Mrs. O'Shaughnessy's baby who fell from the window, were they also then kind of by osmosis getting educated about the political corruption stories and things like that in their midst?
Not only were they getting educated, but this was Pulitzer's great joy. He believed that everything that the paper published was really a wrapper around the editorials. And the editorials were what he either wrote or had his staff write that reflected. So he saw himself as guiding, being the figure that guided their political choices. So yes, corruption was weeded out. He saw journalism, and this comes back from his days in St. Louis of fighting corruption. He saw journalism as like, you know, turning on a flashlight in a dark room and scaring all the cockroaches out. The point was to bring journalistic exposure to all these acts of corruption so that people would see them and things would happen. And that's the kind of journalism he fostered.
When you read this book, it makes one feel that investigative journalism was the norm.
No, you know, I see your point because it's a very action-oriented journalism to go and ferret out these stories. But investigative journalism is really much more a 20th century phenomena because it often depended much more on anonymous sources ferreting out kinds of secrets. The kind of investigative journalism Pulitzer mastered was often taking the obviously available public document. I mean, one of my favorite things is in St. Louis, you had to file an income tax with the city. And you had to fill out the form, just like we do today, and it lists your bank account. How much money do you have in your bank account? Your house? How much is it worth? And some of the wealthiest people in town put zeros. Well, they thought, you know, it's just going to the clerk who would know. Pulitzer, for weeks, just simply took the tax returns and printed them. That's the kind of, you know, investigative journalism. There is one other wonderful, for journalists love this story, St. Louis, a state committee, Senate committee, came to St. Louis to hold a hearing on some very secretive matters they didn't want anyone to know. Pulitzer got permission from the doctor in the office next door to where they were holding the hearing to station a reporter in the closet up against the wall. The reporter took notes of all of the meetings. They rushed it back to the newspaper. Of course, this is an afternoon paper. So as these state senators were leaving their secret meeting where they'd held these hearings, got down to the lobby of the hotel, the newsboys would be there saying, "Read the latest from the hearing." And they'd open up and they'd see all their words there.
That they just said 45 minutes earlier.
And that's the kind of shenanigans he liked. And what he was particularly good at was not only doing that, but promoting it. You see, the next day, this is what we used to call in journalism the second day story, so you'd go out and interview people to get their reaction to the story he broke the day before, thus, you know, giving it more life and getting more attention to his newspaper.
We're talking to James McGrath Morris about his new book, Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power. So he then went to New York and bought a paper called The New York World and made it very big.
Very big. And it's wonderful it has the name The World because it sort of relates to the old movie, The Lost World. Hardly anyone knows of the paper anymore, yet when it ran, it was the most powerful newspaper our country's ever seen. I did a little math and figured out that if the New York Times wanted to be equally powerful today, it would have to increase its circulation by 300%. So its size, its circulation of 1 million when the country was only 78 million was enormous. But more than that, it was printed in color, which people didn't know. The graphic, because if you want to go to the library to see it today, you've got to see it on black and white microfilm. So you have to go and find the original color ones. It printed in color. It was the Sunday paper could last you for a week. It contained things like every week you'd get free sheet music to play, dress patterns you could cut out. Of course, started the Sunday comics, and I still can't live without them. So the paper was far more than just a purveyor of news. It was a form of entertainment and a complete package. It offered everything.
William Randolph Hearst had studied Pulitzer's success and then ended up competing with him.
Very much. Oh, there's so many ironies here. Hearst did. Hearst studied Pulitzer. He's much younger. And the big contrast between the two men is Pulitzer's money was made by himself. Hearst, of course, was using his family's money, his inheritance. So he comes to New York, and he does what Pulitzer did, which is to buy a newspaper rather than start a new one. The wonderful element for me as a writer that gives the book some tension is the newspaper he buys is one that was started by Joseph's brother, Albert. The two boys, the only two who survived the family, both became newspaper publishers. And Albert was very successful. He started the New York Journal, which was doing very well. And he sold it quite handsomely for $1 million. The next owner didn't do very well, and Hearst picked it up. So when Pulitzer gets involved in this incredible circulation war, the likes we've never seen since, with Hearst, he is competing with his brother's paper. And with the kind of sibling rivalry that goes on, this is just an added element of excitement. But Hearst was a very, very clever imitator. He did a lot of things originally, but in an original fashion. But the key to Hearst was he imitated Pulitzer and out-imitated him. He did a better job.
Tell us more about the competition between the two papers.
Well, the competition comes most famously to a head in 1898. And anyone who remembers the American history remembers lines about how two newspapers in New York led us to war, invading Cuba and becoming a colonial power. That's how we get the Philippines and Puerto Rico and other places. And it's like many stories that are told lightly, it's not entirely accurate. But what happened was that Americans became increasingly interested in the oppression of Cubans under Spanish rule. And Hearst saw this as a perfect opportunity to promote his paper. And he started running stories after stories about the scandalous treatments of the Cubans, exciting Americans that this was just couldn't be tolerated on their borders. And the world joined in, so both newspapers began to out-compete. Compete with each other as to how many correspondents could you get to Cuba, and every day there was another tale of outrage there. And this was going along just fine, but in February of 1898, a U.S. naval ship, the Maine, was blown up in the harbor of Havana, killing all on board. And this became the spark that led to the war. And the two newspapers engaged in the most extraordinary excesses. I mean, they made up stories right and left. They had full-page graphics of, you know, drawings of dead seamen, and they really were exciting the United States to enter the war.
Well, so much for the accuracy.
Oh, yeah, the accuracy went up. They also engaged in such fun pilfering that they would steal from each other. You see, these newspapers were being published every hour on the hour in New York. So they'd pick up the 11 o'clock edition, and they'd see that the Journal had a story. They would rewrite it and get it into their paper. So Hearst's paper made up a story about the death of a certain colonel and his name, it's hard to pronounce, it's like Philippe Nonus. And so, of course, the World picked it up and reprinted it. And then the Journal announced in a subsequent edition that's an anagram. If you read it, it says, "We pilfer the news." So that's the kind of wild competition they got into. The one thing that's fun about writing a book like this and being able to examine the history is that I've been able to shift some of the guilt for these excesses off of Pulitzer. And it's not because he's my guy and I wrote the book, but there was something going on that no one at the time knew. In 1897, his daughter had died, and during the height of this moment of excess between these two newspapers, where they're printing editions as quickly as possible, filled with inaccurate news, Pulitzer's in Jekyll Island in Georgia, which is an estate owned by Morgan and all these wealthy people, in complete depression. He's not running the paper. So really what you faced was Randolph Hearst running his paper and pushing his paper to these extremes, and then all of the troops of Pulitzer, without their leader at their paper, desperately trying to compete and doing the same extremes in hopes of saving their boss and their job. And when Pulitzer gets back to New York and realizes the excesses of his paper, he restrained them. However, this stain has remained on him forever. I use a comparison of the famous scene where Sherlock Holmes and, if I remember correctly, Moriarty, his enemy for life, they're both in a struggle in the Swiss Alps and they go off the cliff to their death. Well, Pulitzer's struggle, even though it was his soldiers, not his, with Hearst, forever linked him in history as a purveyor of yellow journalism, which is considered a bad thing.
Joseph Pulitzer worked like a dog. He had a terrible temper. He was massively ambitious. He was very selfish. And he was warned to slow down or his health would fail. And in fact, at the height of his powers, his health did fail in the most horrible way.
And the most dramatic fashion possible. Pulitzer went to work one day and started reading one of his editorials and couldn't read it anymore. And when he went to the doctor, ophthalmology and all of these early names we have for doctors were hardly starting then. So they could look into his eye and they realized he had a detached retina. There was nothing they could do for him. They prescribed bed rest, etc. The consequence was over a period of about 4 or 5 years, he began to go completely blind and he ended up not being able to read his own newspaper. There are two aspects of this tale. I mean, one, from a writer's point of view, it's an extraordinary moment. It's like Beethoven being deaf or anything like that. It's the idea that he can't even read his own masterful creation.
It's even worse than Beethoven being deaf in a sense, because Beethoven kept composing and he could hear the music in his head.
Yes. Well, Pulitzer managed to get around it in one way. He had a staff of 17 men that traveled with him, and several of them were readers. They would practice reading the paper before meeting with him, and they read it visually. They would say things like, in a 72-point headline, "The World Says." And so Pulitzer was able to send back cables to his office with specific instructions if the headline was too big or the content was wrong because of these things that were read. Pulitzer, once he went blind, basically becomes a recluse who travels the world, the Howard Hughes of the 19th century, if you wish. And yet he didn't surrender control of his newspaper. He kept control of his newspaper through telegrams. Telegrams was the internet of the 19th century. The problem with telegrams is that people read them as they're being transmitted, because every operator has to read. So let's say you're J.P. Morgan and you decide you want to buy a certain stock. You send a telegram back to New York. By the time it gets to the New York Stock Exchange, everybody else buys. So people began to communicate in codes. Well, Pulitzer created his own 5,000-word code book, of which there's only one copy left. Without it, we wouldn't have been able to make sense of these telegrams.
The telegrams survive.
The telegrams survive, but, you know, when it says, "What's the potash?" Well, we don't know what that word would mean. And he had codes for his children's health, for the weather, etc. So he controlled his newspaper at a distance using a telegram. The other aspect about his blindness that is sometimes amusing to people. It wasn't to my family. When I turned in this manuscript at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at 8 o'clock the next morning I was having an operation for detached retinas. So I may be over-identified with my subject, but I suffered exactly what happened to Pulitzer. The difference is in a century since, we now have medical means to save my eyesight and I can see again. But I could have lost my eyesight if I'd been in Pulitzer's time. I would have lost my eyesight if I'd lived in Pulitzer's time.
Just as an aside, was that detached retina due to overwork? Is there any way to know?
Well, according to the doctors I've talked to, the answer is no. working under gaslight probably contributed to the deterioration, but that's not the cause of it. And in Pulitzer's case, it was genetic. I've been able to find other descendants of Pulitzer who suffered from the same thing. And actually, the eye doctor for Joseph Pulitzer III retired and lives here in Santa Fe. And the family gave him permission to share the medical records, so I was able to learn more. But in that case, it's a hereditary thing. My case was just pure chance.
We're talking to James McGrath Morris about his biography of Joseph Pulitzer. As you mentioned before, his childhood was marred by a lot of death. His father died and a number of his siblings died before he was 11 years old. And that contributed to his being a hypochondriac all through his life, but particularly after he went blind.
Yeah, when he goes blind, he really descends into a kind of hell. He becomes particularly susceptible to noise. And a lot of people believe that blind people hear better. This is not true. The only time that's true is if a child loses their sight very early, they found that sometimes the hearing muscles change. But for an adult going blind, that's not true. What happened to Pulitzer is he developed these anxieties that were so enormous that made him completely susceptible to worrying about sound of any sort. So when he traveled to Europe before he built his own yacht, and his own yacht, which was huge, had the engines placed particularly in a particular spot to minimize sound, he traveled, for instance, on the White Star Line, which is the famous line that had all these ocean ships. He arranged for special cabin doors to be built, for the pianist to stop playing at 10, and for mats to be put on the deck so that no one would disturb him. So sound was particularly bad. He became hypochondriacal in the sense that he figured every disease he had was the end of his life. And he retained this enormous fear of death, and it's very sad. When his best friends died, when his brother died, he never attended their funerals. He just couldn't bring himself to confront death in that respect, and constantly worried about death.
Now, he came into conflict with Theodore Roosevelt. Tell us that story.
Oh, in an enormous way. They both become archenemies very early on. Pulitzer used humor in his editorials repeatedly. You remember years ago, Dan Quayle made one mistake of spelling, and that kind of humor, or Sarah Palin in Saturday Night. Humor is a very powerful tool in politics. Well, Pulitzer mastered that and used it against Roosevelt. They were enemies, and they had these fights all along when he was police commissioner in New York, etc. Well, when Roosevelt was in his final year as president of the United States, he decided he'd had enough. Pulitzer's paper had suggested that there was corruption involved in the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal, as far as Theodore Roosevelt was concerned, was his great achievement. So Roosevelt ordered the federal government to bring down all its prosecutorial power to try to have Pulitzer imprisoned. We're not talking about fined or sued for libel. His aim was to have him put in prison. If that happened today, you can imagine the headlines. But of course, the hurly-burly world of American politics at the beginning of the 20th century was different. So the final act, a kind of battle of titans, in the last 2 years of Pulitzer's life, he fights one more battle, and that's not only to save himself from prison, but to preserve the right of the First Amendment for a newspaper to criticize a president. And he wins. But it is a big battle.
Now, this is not the first biography of Joseph Pulitzer, but you decided to take this on, and you found some new evidence, some new documentation about his life. Tell us about that and what it adds to our understanding of his life.
Well, I was very lucky. The idea for this book was not mine. It was my editor, HarperCollins, and I believed it had been done. Like many major figures, there had been a lot of biographies of Pulitzer. The best, and the one that still stands up today, was published in 1967. So I began the project quite skeptical I'd find anything new. And as I began to do my research, I started uncovering things. Some were my own skills, and some were just pure luck. Perhaps the two dramatic stories of the materials I uncovered. As we've talked about, Pulitzer had this brother who was a rival. And before his death by suicide in 1909, Albert Pulitzer had written his autobiography, his memoirs. And I knew this from accounts of him staying up late typing and things like that. When he died, his son got a hold of the manuscript and tried to publish it in England, but it never came out. So I believed that somewhere in this world, this manuscript existed. And because the two brothers didn't get along, none of the descendants knew each other. And by some research, I found Albert's granddaughter living in Paris. She was a religious sculptress in her 80s who worked at Saint-Sulpice, the famous cathedral. Her workshop was upstairs. So I wrote her a letter. I sent it by FedEx, not wanting to take any chance. And I got back this wonderfully handwritten note saying that she did indeed have a manuscript. And if I wanted to see it, she'd be glad to let me see it, but she wasn't going to part with it. So I booked a flight on Icelandic, and I was in Paris 2 days later. Got to her apartment. We became very good friends right away, and she let me have a copy and signed a form letting me use it. And it's now at the Columbia University Library, and photographs. And what was so important about this is it gives us, for the first time, somebody else's perspective. So when Pulitzer comes to New York and engages in this rivalry with Albert, we now see Albert's point of view. When Pulitzer is in his early days in St. Louis, he rooms with Albert. So we see that temper and all these different things. So that was one amazing find. The other one I wasn't responsible for, but it has a lot of excitement. About 20 years ago, a carpenter in St. Louis was tearing down a building, and he saw a beautiful wooden box in the dumpster. And he took the box home because it was a beautiful wooden box, opened it up, and found all these documents belonging to Joseph Pulitzer dating back to 1878 when he bought his first newspaper. Columbia University asked me to go and see the documents. And in of themselves, they don't particularly reveal maybe new things, but they were the proof of things we had thought. So it was great. And then perhaps the third find that was an interesting bit of detective work, I found love letters in Ohio between Kate Pulitzer and an anonymous lover. Pulitzer was an impossible man to be married to. When you read this book, you'll be cheering on Kate if she's going to go and find somebody else. The question was, who was this person? And by being able to put together some other evidence I found in an archive in Syracuse, I was able to identify the man who had been her lover. And it's a poignant moment. It's not like exposing something on the front page, you know, read all about it, here's Kate's lover. What it does is it really brings out the larger dimensions of their marriage. And Pulitzer, as I said, was an absolutely impossible man, cruel to his children to a fault, and impossible to his wife. And yet the touching thing is she's the one who really learns to love him and stay with him.
She must have been a saint.
She was. She was. It's interesting. This is a kind of family thing in the sense that in her later years, she wasn't a saintly. She outlives Pulitzer for a long time. So I think for the family, it will be interesting their reaction to read this, because this is a side of Kate they don't know about.
I did want to ask you, I mean, you said a few minutes ago on another subject, I'm not just saying this because I'm writing the biography about him and he's my guy, but when you are writing a biography about somebody, do you kind of, for lack of a better word, fall in love with them? Can you still expose their shortcomings?
Well, I've now written two biographies about people most people wouldn't want to live with, so you do fall in love with the subject, but not necessarily admire them. I think the key is they have to fascinate you. The danger most biographers have is to enlarge the role of their subject. You're going to look at many biographies, the subtitle will be the story of so-and-so and how he changed America forever and that kind of thing. Pulitzer had a very significant role, but I think I balance it in the sense that the achievements, I like the best is that he was the midwife to the creation of the modern mass media. He's not an Edison. He didn't do it alone. Lots of people were doing similar things. But yeah, the key, if you're going to spend 6 years with somebody, which means that you're going to think about them in the shower in the morning, you're thinking about them at night, has to be somebody that fascinates you. Love is a dangerous thing because Pulitzer has a lot of warts. And if I couldn't portray those, this wouldn't be as a fair a portrait. As a former reporter, I would be unfair to my readers in doing that.
It is. And I don't know how you biographers do this, but there is that sense as you're reading it that you are walking through the day with them. You can hear the floorboards creaking. You can smell the air. You weren't there. And yet you're able to somehow recreate it in a way that I suppose has at least a little bit of creative imagination in it.
I think the key to being a biographer is to be obsessive. For the last 6 years, I haven't read a new book. And the reason is what I read are the novels that were read to Pulitzer. If I could, and I did often, I'd listen to the music that he did, that he listened to. You try to get yourself into the person's skin. You revisit places they walked. You go to houses that they lived in attempts to try to recreate their lives. But the cautionary tale here is, just like anybody who paints a landscape, You can go into an art gallery and see six different landscapes of the same hills, and they're all going to be different. Where you stand, how you interpret the material, your sentiments, your feelings of what are important and what is not is what you bring out in your landscape. Somebody else could write a biography of Pulitzer tomorrow that would have a very different take on his life.
So, having said that, we don't want to say the subtitle is How Did He Change America Forever? How did he change America? How did he change journalism?
I think he changed journalism in a number of ways. One, the fact that we consume news nonstop is a legacy of Pulitzer. The news is a commodity. The idea of finding news and making money out of it is something that was different in the United States and helped create the mass media. And the form of journalism that we have today, the sense of a lead in a newspaper, it's not him alone, but he's really greatly responsible. Before Pulitzer came, and this is a big generalization, and somebody who's precise is going to say, well, I'm being too general, but still, this is the point. Before Pulitzer's time and before Pulitzer, newspapers were boring. They were subscribed to by the wealthy, and they featured a classic thing. Every day, I might say, had the same headline, same size, letter from London. And you'd read this letter, and you'd get to the bottom, and you'd realize the Crimean War is over. Pulitzer turned that all around. You'd have a 72-point headline, war is over, peace at last, pictures, drawings, exciting copy that made reading fun and interesting and entertaining. And so the magic of Pulitzer was to take the mundane aspects of our daily lives and turn them into a form of entertainment and thus sell it and thus make money, which has ended up creating NBC, ABC, NPR, and every kind of news-gathering enterprise. The key to it is that we're not just reporting, we are telling stories. And that is certainly a legacy of Pulitzer. Not Pulitzer alone, but of Pulitzer.
And he was responsible for the creation of a school of journalism.
Yes, in his death he left the money that created the Journalism School at Columbia University in New York. And that was complicated because Columbia thought journalism was a trade, and what Ivy League school would want that. Secondly, they were not necessarily comfortable with having a Jewish name on a building next to Schermerhorn and all these other elite members of New York families. But yes, he left his money in two ways. One, to create a journalism school that's produced many of America's best journalists. And secondly, to leave a prize. The prize was something he did at his newspapers. He rewarded reporters quite regularly with prizes, so it followed his notion. And I think the most interesting thing of his legacy is that the most important prize he left was for public service. That's the prize he valued the most.
James McGrath Morris is author of the book Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power. And once again, he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday the 9th of February, at 7 in the evening. You can also find James on his website, jamesmcgrathmorris.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Robert Benjamin. He is author of the new play, Parted Waters, which is being presented by Teatro Paraguas, and Argus McCallum joins us. He's the artistic director of Teatro Paraguas, and Fran Martone joins us as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a play about crypto-Jews of northern New Mexico. There's been quite a lot of plays or quite a lot of literature and activity surrounding this theme in the last few years.
Yes, there has been.
How did you decide to take on this material?
The origin of the play was a commission from the Arizona Jewish Theater Company in Phoenix. They've been looking for a play on this topic for several years, and so the artistic director there twisted my arm.
Now, did you have a connection to the material in some way? Personally, family, or anything like that?
Not directly, but I've lived here for a long time.
And so how did you go about researching the history of crypto-Jews and finding the emotional, thematic elements to make a play?
Well, I used a historical resource, Stan Horty's book, To the End of the Earth, and then I interviewed a lot of people, went to conferences on the topic and such, and I've been living around here a long time, so I'm familiar with the culture as well.
So Teatro Paraguas is always doing plays that take on cultural themes that are about New Mexico.
Yes, this play is very significant because the crypto-Jewish population is very important in northern New Mexico, and it's estimated that maybe perhaps 1 in 10 Hispanics in northern New Mexico does have crypto-Jewish blood.
One in ten.
Yes. This is a very dynamic play because it has three generations of men in the same family. The grandfather, whom I'm very privileged to play, Reynaldo, is a traditional viejo. He farms up there near Trucha somewhere. The son, Miguel, has different cultural values. He's working for a corporation in Albuquerque. And the son, the third generation, is becoming active in issues of hydrology and water rights and is running a campaign.
So he's running for office.
That's correct. And he does not know about the crypto-Jewish roots in the family. Reynaldo, the grandfather, has urged his son, Javier, to explain to Miguel that the family does have crypto-Jewish blood. But Javier does not wish to. So a lot of tension and dramatic situation is created by that impasse.
Fran, what is your role?
I'm the director of the play, and I'm fascinated, of course, with the specific locale and the specific local themes, but I think it's a much deeper and broader look at the issues of identity, and that's what really attracted me to the play, because as we identify ourselves as a woman, as a Jewish person, as a black or whatever, that brings us a lot of community, but it also, as we've seen in the world recently, can bring a lot of tension and problems as well. So that sort of balance between what identity brings us in terms of gifts and in terms of curse fascinates me.
We're also going through a period in history where there's a great deal of revision about the meaning of race or so-called blood. And as I was reading through the play, I thought, what is it even, on a deep level, what does it even mean to have that DNA?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. What does it mean? And what do we choose to make it mean? What do other people impose on us because we have this particular trait or whatever. There's a really interesting book by Emerita Sen called Identity and Violence, and I used that as some preparation as I was getting ready to direct this play. And I have to say the actors and the script are both amazing. Robert always writes plays that have moral ambiguity and lots of different threads, and they're always fascinating to unravel.
Have you found, just in observing the situation of northern New Mexico now, that people are more comfortable with speaking of their crypto-Jewish heritage, if that's something that they've known about?
I've observed that some people are comfortable speaking about it, and others are less comfortable. So there is still the question of, is it something I want to share with people?
So all of these themes, and of course, love interest is explored in this play, and it's interesting that one of the characters is having a flirtation with a woman who's actually a Jewish woman from, I think, is she from out of state?
Well, she moved here. I mean, she wasn't. She's not a native to New Mexico,
right,
but she is openly Jewish, as you say. Yes.
Exactly, and so we won't give too much away. It's the source of much possible and actual conflict in this play, Parted Waters, which opens this coming Thursday at the Teatro Paraguas Studios. It runs Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it's an evening performance at 7 o'clock. Sundays, it's a matinee. And it's at the studio at 3221 Richards Lane in Santa Fe. And then that's for 2 weekends. And then after that, it's going to be at the Brian Fant Theater at Capital High School. And for more information, people can go to teatroparaguas.org, and they can call 505-424-1601. Robert Benjamin, Fran Martone, and Argus McCallum, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.
Thank you.